Right. So the students, right, so Rabbi Akiva for 12 years, Rabbi Akiva went out, left his wife to study. Now, Rabbi Akiva's story was that at the age of 40, he knew either nothing or he knew very little. Some say maybe he did know something, I'm not sure, but most of the conventional is that he didn't know anything. And then he got married to this woman who saw his potential. She sent him away to study, where he started at nothing. And then at 12 years later, he comes back and he overhears her telling a friend that I'd be happy if he would continue in his study. So he went for another 12 years. So when he came back at the end of those 24 years, he had at that point the 24,000 students. And then we know that they were all wiped out, which is, you can imagine you would be broken. Rabbi Akiva got up and he went to the south and he started with five students. And with those five students, they end up becoming the basis of most of the oral tradition is based on those five students. Rabbi Meir is one of them, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is another. So this Gemara, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi. So this Gemara is talking about, it starts out with a discussion with three of the students, and then it goes into Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's story. So this is Gemara on in Shabbos, Daf 33b. So we'll say like this. So in this Braita, Rabbi Yehuda is described as head of the speakers in every place. So the Gemara asks, why did they call him head of the speakers in every place? The Gemara relates that this resulted due to an incident that took place when Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon were sitting, and Rabbi Yehuda, son of convert, sat beside them. Rabbi Yehuda opened and said, "How pleasant are the actions of this nation," meaning the Romans, "as they establish marketplaces, establish bridges, and establish bathhouses." Rabbi Yossi was silent. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, our Rabbi Shimon, responded and said, "Everything they established only for their own purposes. They established marketplaces to place prostitutes in them, bathhouses to pamper themselves, and bridges to collect taxes from all of who pass over them." Rabbi Yehuda, son of converts, went and related their statements to his household, and those statements continued to spread until they were heard by the monarchy. I mean, it got back to the Romans. They ruled and said, "Rabbi Yehuda, who elevated the Roman regime, shall be elevated and appointed as head of the sages, the head of the speakers in every place." That's how we got here. Rosh HaMadabrim. Rabbi Yossi, who remained silent, shall be exiled from his home in Judea as punishment, and sent to the city of Tzipori in the Galilee. And Rabbi Shimon, who denounced the government, shall be killed. Okay, so there's a death sentence on Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son Rabbi Elazar went and hid in the study hall. Every day, Rabbi Shimon's wife would bring them bread and a jug of water, and they would eat. When the decree intensified, Rabbi Shimon said to his son, "Women are easily impressionable, and therefore, there is room for concern lest the authorities torture her and she reveal our whereabouts." They went and they hid in a cave. A miracle occurred, and a carob tree was created for them, as well as a spring of water. They would remove their clothes and sit covered in sand up to their necks. They would study Torah all day in that manner. At the time of prayer, they would dress, cover themselves, and pray, and they would again remove their clothes afterward so that they would not become tattered. They sat in the cave for 12 years. Elijah the prophet came and stood at the entrance to the cave and said, "Who will inform Bar Yochai, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that the emperor died and his decree has been abrogated?" They emerged from the cave. This is right. It was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son, and saw people who were plowing and sowing. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, "These people abandon eternal life of Torah study and engage in temporal life for their own sustenance." The Gemara relates that every place that Rabbi Shimon and his son, Rabbi Elazar, directed their eyes was immediately burned. A divine voice emerged and said to them, "Did you emerge from the cave in order to destroy my world? Return to your cave." They again went and sat there for 12 months. They said, the judgment of the wicked in Gehenna, lasts for 12 months. Surely their sin was atoned in that time. A divine voice emerged and said to them, emerge from your cave. They emerged everywhere that Rabbi Elazar would strike, Rabbi Shimon would heal. Rabbi Shimon said to Rabbi Elazar, my son, you and I suffice for the entire world.
Jonathan, could you scroll down? I can't hear you. Can you scroll back? Thanks.
Okay. As the two of us emerged in the proper study of Torah. Okay, so just I'm reading this, and then we're going to go back, and we're going to analyze the stuff. As the sun was setting on Shabbat Eve, they saw an elderly man who was holding two bundles of myrtle branches and running at twilight. They said to him, why do you have these? He said to them, in honor of Shabbat. They said to him, and let one suffice. Why do you have two branches? He answered them, one is corresponding to remember the Shabbos day and to keep it, and one is corresponding to observe the Shabbos day and to keep it holy. Rabbi Shimon said to his son, see how beloved the mitzvot are to Israel. Their minds were put at ease, and they were no longer as upset that people were not engaged in Torah study. And then just the final clip here, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, who was Rabbi Shimon's son-in-law, heard and went out to greet him. He brought him into the bathhouse and began tending to his flesh. He saw that Rabbi Shimon had cracks in the skin of his body, on his body, and he was crying, and the tears fell from his eyes and caused Rabbi Shimon pain. Rabbi Pinchas said to Rabbi Shimon, his father-in-law, woe is to me that I have seen you like this. Rabbi Shimon said to him, happy are you that you have seen me like this. As had you not seen me like this, you would not have found in me this prominence in Torah. As the Gemara related, at first when Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai would raise a difficulty, Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair would respond to his question with 12 answers. Ultimately, when Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair would raise a difficulty, Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai would respond with 24 answers. Okay? So, just as a parenthetical, it's important to know that Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair is famously known as the one who... There's a very famous book called Mesilat Yesharim, which I don't know if you're familiar with, if you've seen it or heard of it. So that book is based on the teaching of Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair. So you can imagine Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair was a serious, the whole Mesilat Yesharim is based on the teaching of Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair, and he's already, you see that there's a progression here that Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair was a son-in-law of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai before Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai went into the cave, was on one level, was on a lower level in a sense, and then when he emerges, he becomes that much more superior to all those around him. Okay, so now, let's try to understand what's going on here, okay? And what's really, the Gemara is shrouded a little bit, but it's messaging. One of the clear messages, obviously, is that as a result of the 12 years plus 12 months that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and his son were in the cave, they've the way the Gemara is saying here at the end here, that they became extremely, they went to a different level, right? They just catapulted to a different level. And perhaps this is where all these incredible secrets of the depths of Torah emerge from this incredible or crazy experience of them 12 years sitting in a cave. Now, what's the significance of the 12 years and the 12 months? And what would you, any ideas on that? Right, so we said Rabbi Akiva, his teacher. So Rabbi Akiva, his teacher.
Oh, he learned for 12 years.
12 years, right? Comes back, here's his wife, goes back for another 12 years. So the Gemara is subtly telling us that there's this very interesting parallel between Rabbi Akiva, the teacher, and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the student. That Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai also goes through a 12-year plus a 12-month, which maybe corresponds to another 12 years, of similar to Rabbi Akiva's experience, let's just say. Now, Rabbi Akiva, you see that Rabbi Akiva has a very Rabbi Akiva's life is one of that's complex, and we see that there's a lot of ups and downs. Rabbi Akiva is known as the one. We did the Gemara with Rabbi Akiva, right? Of Kol David Rachman al Tavavit. Everything that God does is for the best. That crazy story where he goes into a village, and he can't find a place to sleep, and then he ends up going outside, and his light goes out, his animals get killed, and then he wakes up the next morning to find out that if he would have been in that village that night, he would probably have been killed because it was raided by some group that destroyed the village. So Rabbi Akiva is the one who always has this refrain of everything's for the best. And you see this, there's a link. Rabbi Akiva had a teacher, Nachum Ish Gamzu, who was the one who taught him this idea of always seeing that everything that God does is for the best. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai now is a student from after the tragedy of the 24,000 students perishing. And he's in the second smaller group that ends up becoming, the progenitors of all of the oral tradition, or major impact. Let's say like that. So then you have this situation with Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon Yochai, talking about the Romans. So you see that the backdrop of all. Of Rabbi Akiva's life and Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda, the students, is that you see that there's this, they're dealing with the Romans, the oppressors, and that it's interesting to see that how Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon are understanding, how do they understand the activities of the Romans, right? So here you have Rabbi Yehuda starting out, and he says, look at how incredible all the great things that the Romans have done for society, for civilization, right? They've created bridges, marketplaces, bathhouses. The Romans built beautiful and very, the waterworks and things that, really substantial, things for society. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is of the opinion that it's true that they did it, but their motivation. Now, what's really incredible, if you go through the Gemaras in Shabbos, that there's two people that are constantly arguing, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. Okay, listen to this. This is a beautiful idea. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon argue on Shabbos in terms of the approach to the laws of Shabbos. We have a davar she'eino miskaven. Let's say you have something that davar she'eino miskaven means, it's translated as if you do something that you didn't have the intent to do. So the classic example is I take a bench and I pull the bench because I want to pull the bench as a side or as a secondary thing that happens is that I accidentally make a furrow in the ground. It's a heavy bench. I'm pulling it. I wasn't really paying attention. I wanted the bench and I ended up making a furrow, which you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. So how do we understand what's the halachic? What is the ruling as to whether that's a problem or not? So it's a machlok. There's a dispute as to how we understand it. So Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda argue is the side, the secondary action that I had no intent of doing, is that a problem or not? So Rabbi Shimon says, what your intent is what matters. My intention was to take a bench. I had no intention of making a furrow. And it doesn't always happen that a furrow occurs. It depends on, let's say, we can just say like, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't when I drag the bench. If it's for sure that it's going to happen, that might be a different discussion. But what we see in the Gemara and Shabbos, not this Gemara, but in general, like when the Gemara goes through all these different things, Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda are always arguing on what matters is your intent, right? So you think about it here. So what are they arguing about here? Rabbi Yehuda is saying, look at how incredible what the Romans built. Rabbi Shimon says, I'm not impressed, because what does Rabbi Shimon care about? The intent, right? He's always focused on the intention. So Rabbi Shimon says, it's very nice that they built all these things, but what's key is the person's intent. And so the Romans, it's true that they built all these incredible things, but what was their intention? Their intention was for improper things, for prostitution, for pleasure, all about, you know, themselves, better, nothing to do, right? So Rabbi Shimon's always, Davar Shen Meskavim, the reason why you're not responsible for something that's as a side thing is because you didn't have intent for that. So it's all about your intent. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda says, no, I just care about the action. The action's what matters. So you see over here, the same thing that they always are arguing in other parts of Shabbos, here it comes into a discussion about whether Romans, what they did, was it proper or not, based on intent or not. So the bottom line is that Rabbi Shimon, because of his opinion, he ends up having to run away. Okay, so he and his son, which is interesting that his son had to go with him, but his son goes with him, and Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Shimon, and the two of them go, and they're miraculously able to survive for 12 years in the cave, right? And this idea of the carob tree coming and was created and for them in a spring of water, and that they had to take off their clothing to be able to, so that their clothing wouldn't be, you know, they'd be able to preserve their clothing for when they needed it, when it was necessary. But then they basically, can you imagine, no TV, no Netflix, no distractions for 12 years. And that led them to have an incredibly intense Torah study for 12 years. So much so that when they come out, look at where their heads are at, is that they emerged from the cave and saw people who were plowing and sowing. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, these are people abandon eternal life of Torah study or eternal life and engage in temporal life for their own sustenance. So then at that point, they basically, you see at this point, Rabbi Shimon and his son are burning everybody. They're now, whether this is literal or figurative, right? Do they have that, like, were they, do they have like, the laser eyes that they were like literally like, you know, or not, you know, I don't know. You don't have to, like, you know, do we take it literally or not? But what we see is that their perspective after they came out from the cave was that they completely like were divorced from any type of the physical reality of the world. Like they couldn't relate to anything of that. There could be even any type of positive thing coming out of the mundane aspects of this world. But, and at that point, the divine voice emerged and said to them, you know, you care to destroy my world? Get back in the cave. So there was something missing. There was something missing, and it's possible at this point that needed to, that lesson for them to have to go back in for another 12 months, is that now Rabbi Shimon, when he emerges, whereas let's say his son, when they come out, right, when they emerged, right, we see that they emerged, and at this point Rabbi Shimon would heal, because now Rabbi Shimon got the message. He understood that there is a balance that can be, you know, that one can attain. It's not, the idea of purely, being, in the spiritual realm, that there can be, you can bring the spiritual into the physical realm. But Rabbi Lezer maybe still represented that other side, but here now Rabbi Shimon's there to heal.
What changed in the interim that they, what made them have to hide in the cave, and what happened that they were allowed to emerge from the cave?
Okay, so we go back to here. So the Gemara said that they because it got back to the Romans, that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was saying negative things about them, against the Roman rulership, right? So he says, and Shimon, who denounced the government, shall be killed. So there was, he got a death, he had a death sentence on his head, but then he was able to emerge when Elijah the prophet came and stood at the entrance to the cave and said, who will inform Bar Yochai, maybe Shimon Bar Yochai, that the emperor died and the decree had been abrogated, right? So over the 12 years, whoever was in power at that point had passed away. And so
what point in their lives were they at? Like, how old, is there any idea, like, how old they were? Like, when they gave from age 25 to 37 with a 5-year-old, or?
No, so I think that Rabbi Lezer, his son, was already older. So it must be, you know, it could, I would even throw it out there. Maybe he was in, that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was in his 40s, or I'm just guessing. I'm playing with that number.
His son had to be somewhat old enough because it says that they were studying in there. So
right. I can't. Yeah. So I mean, let's say he's anywhere from the Rosh Shimon Bar Yochai is already in his 40s and his son's in his 20s, but that's a guess. I would have to dig to see if there's anybody that identifies like how old they were at the time. It's an interesting question.
I do have a question regarding to the Gemara itself. So, does this thing where he comes out and then is sent back into the cave for the 12 months afterwards change his opinion or his side, so to speak, of intent to action? In other words, now that he comes out and sees this, and then he's sent back into the cave. Does it change his opinion of action versus intent?
No. So that's always Rabbi Shimon's position throughout Shas, throughout the Talmud, is this idea that your intention is what matters. That never changes. The question really what the piece really is, where we see emerge. Is that Rabbi Shimon, who at one point became so, I want to use the word extreme, but so removed from the physical, that after the second 12 months helps him really address kind of a little, maybe the issues of Rabbi Akiva had also, that maybe there was there was something missing. There was something that needed to be he needed to like learn a lesson. And then you see, at least in this piece, it's very clear that whereas he came out after 12 years and was, very kind of extreme, let's say, that we see the shift, that he becomes much more accepting of that other side, that there could be, within the physical, an acceptance of that there's something. And if you look over here, like this part over here, this is very. I think this is the most beautiful thing, is that he says here. As the Gemara says, as the sun was setting on a Friday afternoon, Shabbat Eve, they saw an elderly man who was holding two bundles of myrtle branches running at twilight. They said to him, why do you have these? And he says, meaning why do you have two? Isn't one enough? And then he said, no, one is for Zachor and one is for Shamor. One is for remember and one's for observe. And that one is really, Zachor is more of a positive action, whereas Shamor is to refrain. And Rav Shimon said, you see how special, how beloved the mitzvot are to Israel. But it's more than that. It's that what they saw in this is now you see the balance between action and then holding back. That you need that balance. Basically, Zachor and Shamor is really the balance between activity and cessation from activity, and that they go hand in hand, that there's not one without the other, and then that's really What the takeaway from Rosh Shimon is that he understood now, after the 12 additional months, is that there is this, you know, again, we're talking about this, so let's go back a step, or let's take a side for a minute, is that Rosh Shimon Bar Yochai is the one who discovers or who reveals to us the hidden depths of Kabbalah, right? He's the one who comes with the Zohar. And so he's the one who, you know, and it could be that the 12 years of, and the 12 years plus the 12 months that he was in the cave, that he's able to reach these incredible, you know, secrets of the Torah, the deepest parts of the Torah, and then reveals it to us, but that from the deepest place, the idea of getting to the depths and then also being able to like straddle or go from the deepest places to the most, you know, call it the surface types of things. Not the opposite of the depths, the most, you know, surface physical, you know, types of things that you can straddle both worlds. And that a person, think of Shabbos, right? How do we observe Shabbos? We say you're supposed to eat, you're supposed to enjoy. There's an Oneg Shabbos, this idea of enjoying, physically enjoying Shabbos. But at the same time, you're supposed to think about lofty things on Shabbos. So this idea of like, so how does that work? But the answer is, that's exactly the point, is that this old man took two myrtles that represented those two aspects, and he said, you need both, because they come together. And Rav Shimon said to his son, you see how beloved the mitzvot are to Israel? But the idea is that you can take these two extremes and bring them together, and they coexist. And that's what Rabbi Shimon was able to gain after going through this experience. Meaning, when you go to that extreme of 12 years of being cut off from anything that's really physical, he literally had what he just the bare minimum to live, and he's completely consumed with the highest and most deepest secrets of the universe, you lose complete, you know, connection to like the physical realms and the normal, like, you know, day to day. And maybe, you know, what's interesting is that you see from this, it's very interesting, where Shimon already going into the cave came with his perspective of the intent is what matters, right? It's not what you do, it's what your intent. I mean, not to say that what you do doesn't matter, but the intent is what is the driver that makes the most, that's the most important thing of deciding whether or not what you did was, right? Like here with the Romans, right? What they did, who cares? I mean, it was all for ulterior motives, and that's what matters. It's the motive. But then you see as we see a progression, so that within that mindset of Rabbi Shimon, after going through his experience of 12 years and 12 months, that he comes out and then he understands there's a need for balance. Right, and the idea that his son might look at things and still burn a hole through it, but the Rosh Hashanah would come and heal it, and that and then the Gemara ends off here with his son-in-law Pinchas Ben Yair, that you see that it did take its toll on him physically, is that his body was like his skin was like a mess, right? You see, he had cracks in the skin on his body. And that, you know, physically, it took its toll. But it with that in mind, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai had reached a different level. And so, this year, I don't think it's going to, you know, maybe there'll be a handful, like in years prior, let me see if I can bring up a picture.
So Jonathan, is it possible that one of the reasons that I've always heard that learning Kabbalah shouldn't be undertaken by somebody who didn't fully or understand Torah more, you know, the idea come from this, where he had, in order to really be able to benefit or get to the level, I mean, they had to really, I mean, he sequestered himself. I mean, granted, he wrote the Zohar, which makes it more accessible, but I've always heard, you know, I think it's lessened since Madonna started getting involved in Kabbalah, but but it seemed like for the longest time they really were discouraging people from learning.
No, so I'll tell you, I'll tell you what the answer is. I could teach you Kabbalah now, okay? We could open up, we could start learning Kabbalah, but you won't appreciate it if you didn't go through the basics. So, like, a person who doesn't have a basic understanding of the Torah, the five books, and then the Nevi'im, the prophets, and then you go through the Mishnah and the Talmud, and as you go through all those things, and then you learn, because it's all built on that. So it's true. It's true that you can access it. I mean, I can explain it to you. If you have a good teacher, the ability for that. If the teacher is a good teacher, they can bring you some understanding, but your appreciation for the depths of what it really is being said. The meaning, like again, we can go through Talmudic pieces, and if we don't stop and really like. Go through it and, like, you know, delve and ask the questions and then say, you know, like this whole idea, for example, the fact that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Yehuda have an argument, a standing argument about the, about Devar Shon HaMiskaven, this idea of how, you know, does intent matter or not? If I didn't tell you that, you'd go through this piece. You would never know that Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda happen to have a much more global type of disagreement. But when you have that piece, it makes it, you're like, oh, okay, you know, it brings a whole different, you know, understanding as to what's going on here. You know, so that's just like a little, you know. Thing, but you understand that. Let me show you. Here's just a little. Let me bring this up for you. Let's take a look at this. This is.
That is a Svat, near Svat.
Yeah, it's near Svat. So you see over here. This is from like maybe a year or two ago. Let's see if I can get a good. It's wild. They were getting like, you know, you see like the back over here. There's the green mount. This is Meiron.
Okay.
So if you we all go to to Tzvat or nearby, and we go to the Ariz Mikvah, right? The ice cold Mikvah. Yep. It's right nearby. So this is them getting ready for the bonfire, and putting a lot of oil on there, getting ready
burning
for
man.
Yeah.
It's a Jewish Burning Man special.
Yeah, pretty much, right? Mahav deal, as they say, like that means to separate. Like,
they took the name Burning Man.
Like, yeah. So let me see here. I want to show you this. Where is it?
Clearly, this was not during coronavirus time.
This is not. This is probably from like.
Start the bonfire.
Here, let me. I want to tell you a cool thing background here, if I can find it. Yeah, they started it there.
Burning Man's in the desert too.
Here, you see. Look at that. Look at how many people are there. Now, this is. It's really a Hasidic. It, you know, if you look at the people that are there, these are Hasidic, you know, it's more of a Hasidic crowd. So this is, you know, it became more of a, but it, you know, when you go there on, you know, this year, it's going to be a shell of it, but, and that probably, who knows if anybody's there or not, but let's see what happened here. Where's my, wait a second, I lost the, oh, I closed it.
I mean, unless the armies are keeping him away.
No, they're not going to. They're not going to go. They won't be there. They will not be there. They will not be there. They're not unless. No, they will not. They won't. Yeah. So, yeah. So, but Lag BaOmer became it, you know, Kabbalistically, it's the Hod Shebahod. It's like. It's this very auspicious day. It took on, in the last, you know, 15 years, it took on this much more, you know, maybe 20 years, it's become even, you know, it keeps on growing in terms of, you know, people going there. They, you know, that's also the Sephardic Jews are very connected to the day, and they go up to Meron as well. And, you know, people take their kids to get their upshearing. You know what that is, the upshearing? Their kids, like, they wait till they're 3 years old to give the boys the haircuts. They'll go specifically on Lag BaOmer. They'll wait. So the kid's like three, and they'll wait till he's to Lag BaOmer of that year, and they go up to Meron to do the haircut there on Lag BaOmer. So it's
When is or what?
So when is Lag BaOmer? It's this week, Monday night. Monday night, Tuesday. So last night and today is the 31st day of the Omer. Right, we're counting 49 days. So from the second day of Pesach, we count 49 days, and the 50th day is Shavuot. It's the only holiday on the Jewish of these big holidays that doesn't have a calendar day. Right, Passover is the 15th of Nisan. Rosh Hashanah is the first day of Tishrei. Yom Kippur is the 10th day. Sukkot is the 15th day of Tishrei. Shavuot, because they're the three, we call them the three legs, the Shalosh Regalim, is Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot, those three. And Passover and Sukkot have a calendar date. Shavuot has no calendar date. When exactly was the revelation at Sinai? Well, it's also, there's a dispute, is it the 6th or the 7th of Sivan? But what everybody agrees upon is that it really is based on the count. So from the second day of Passover, meaning the day after the first day of Passover, we bring the Karban Omer. The Karban Omer was a barley offering. Now, this is a pretty, listen to this very intricate idea. The Omer is brought, it's a sacrifice from barley. They would go and cut it, and they would bring this sacrifice, and that would be actually permit all of the grain that was grown from the second day of Passover for the entire year. So let's say, for example, Passover, day one, day two, they do this Karban Omer. It now permits all the grain that was grown the prior year from the second day of Passover going forward from that time. They would have to actually take all the grain, store it, wait till the following year, Passover, day two, they'd bring this barley offering, and now you're allowed to have all the prior year's grain. It's called chadash, which means new, okay? People still keep it today. In Israel, for sure, no question that they do. It's a requirement. The question is, do you keep it outside the land of Israel? There are people... Like, if you go to a store, I don't know if maybe you'll look at this. You go to a kosher pizza store, in the window, it might say, we keep yashan. Yashan means old. What it's saying is that we are careful not to have grain that's grown from Passover day two up until the next Passover until the Omer was brought, the 16th of Nisan. So all the grain from that year is still considered to be what they call chadash, new, until the following year, the 16th of Nisan. Then all that other becomes yashan, it becomes old. Okay? Now what's going on here? So this is the cool idea. And we'll talk about this next week, God willing, about the idea of in tefillin. There are four paragraphs that we have in our tefillin. One of them is focused on the idea of that you have to take the firstborn cow and dedicate it. Bechor becomes dedicated. Also, the firstborn male would have to be dedicated. And we have this thing called Pidyon HaBen. I don't know if you've ever heard of that phrase. I'm talking to three guys who only have daughters. Right?
We didn't go through it, but I remember it.
Okay, so I had a son, but I didn't have to do it because I'm a Kohen. But if you're not a Kohen or a Levi, so if you're an Israelite who has a firstborn male that's born naturally, no cesarean, you have to do a Pidyon HaBen. You have to redeem the child at 30 days. after the child is born. It's called a pinyon aben. Why? It goes back to the fact that during the time of Egypt, when we left, that God killed the firstborn Egyptians. Any firstborn Egyptian was killed during the 10th plague, the Makat Bechorot. And then God said, I spared you, now I own you. I own, in a sense, the firstborn. And so if you want, you have to redeem the child back. And so too, there's this idea of you have to also give your firstborn, you know, animal. And so everything about the firsts. So too, what's the first commandment that the Jews get as a people? Is the idea of HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, Rosh Chodeshim. The first month, the first of the year is Nisan. But what it really means is that we have this idea of using the lunar calendar as our way of counting time. It's not a pure lunar calendar. It's actually a lunar that's connected to the solar, or whatever. But the idea is idea of renewal, something that's new. The first becomes the focal point, the first. So that's the same idea. This idea of the Omer is that it is brought to enable or to allow the new in. So that Passover is the beginning of something, of a cycle for us. And the Omer is part of that idea of mottering, of allowing the new to be allowed, because we're always focused on the first thing, the new. It becomes a very important thing, the idea of being able to renew, to become back to that place. So it's from that day of when we bring that barley offering, where we allow the new, that we count 49 days, because now we're on a progression. We're in a process of counting, of moving from this place of the Omer, 49 days till we get ourselves to the revelation at Sinai, to receive the Torah. And what's crazy is that we do it every year. It's not like a one-time thing. Every single year we come back to this. We go through this process. Because what it really is saying is that it wasn't a one-time event per se. It's a eternal event. Because it's something that we have to go back and experience. We come back to Passover every year. We go through this process. And now we're on that road. So what should have been is that the 49 days should have been the happiest thing. It should have been the happiest time. What ended up happening in our history is that you end up having the tragedy of Rabbi Akiva's students. There's like a real failure that becomes embedded within our experience of this time period. Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day, became a respite and became almost like there was a revelation of sorts from Rav Shimon Bar Yochai of the hidden parts of Torah, and the cessation of the death. Like, it was almost like, okay, whatever failure occurred there, it something, you know, we had a stoppage that it was like, okay, time out, or it's over. And then now we're 17 days away when we hit 33, we're 17 days away from Revelation, and the gematria of Tov, of good, is 17. Right. So, but the idea is that we're past that darkness or the difficulty that occurred there, and we're on our way to getting that much closer to this incredible event. Again, reconnecting to that place of when we got to experience God in the most, you know, intense way that we could possibly, and still be physical beings. And then from there, we're supposed to take that Torah and incorporate into our lives and to continue the process of growth and etc. But you see this idea that there is a struggle. This story of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is a struggle of how do we balance the spiritual and the physical realms. So Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's experience was to go to that extreme of being completely anti-physical, not the idea of incorporation. But then he goes through that process. He's able to reach the depths of something, and then the idea is to bring it back and to then incorporate it in. And that's what the idea that this elderly man, right, where he goes as the sun was setting on Shabbat Eve, because Shabbos also is a day of bringing it all together, right? Shabbos is special because it's the day in creation where you had 6 days of just endless creation, and then on the seventh day when things ceased, there was a we call it like this idea of everything coming together and being incorporated in. And that's what this what's so symbolic of this old elderly man, right? So someone who perhaps that's part of what's going on. The symbolism here is an elderly man. It's someone that's gone through life. He's holding two bundles of myrtle branches at twilight. And it's because he wants to be able to merge the two. These two worlds, the physical and the spiritual, come together. It's not one thing. Rav Shimon said to his son, "See how beloved the mitzvot are to Israel." But it's more than that. Because what's really being said here is the idea of the merging of these two worlds together. And that's really what the Talmud is saying. And that's kind of what's going on with Lag BaOmer, is that you can reveal the deepest secrets, the deepest mysteries of the world, of creation, of Torah, and at the same time be a regular, and live in this world and elevate this world. When you mold those two, things together, you raise everything up.
That's so interesting. As a tale about the struggle of learning. I mean, you hear this, Rabbi Shimon went into the cave, and he's already learned. Now he goes into this cave, 12 years, study, spiritual introspection, and it comes out after 12 years, and it's like, yeah, he gained something from the 12 years. It doesn't say, oh, it was a waste of time. It's like so far off, but like it comes out. It's almost like, oh, you learn, and you learn enough. It's like somebody said, oh, I know just enough to be dangerous, and come out. And you need that like finishing touch, that little polish. And it could be, oh, you're only 12 months away, but you needed this experience to come out. To have this kind of negativity, or just see that, I'm a little bit off. And then, just a little bit further, you're almost at that next level. It's just kind of interesting that, into this 12 years of deep introspection, it came out off, and it almost ties into, I think the story you were saying of Rabbi Akiva's students, here they were studying with the greatest guy, one of the greatest guys in Jewish history, and they hit a point where, you guys learned it, but you're off so much that it's almost like another plague story.
Yeah, no, so that's, what's interesting is on Friday, I never heard this before, it's a pretty wild idea, so Rabbi Neuberger was telling over, he does like a Zoom call on Friday afternoon. So he quoted, he said that there was someone that lived here in our community. He fortunately passed away. They moved to Israel 17 years ago. The reason I know is because I bought his house. So his name was Josh Lipsitz, Alav Shalom. So he, his wife called Rabbi Neuberger. They're very close with the Neubergers. And she told Rabbi Neuberger, my husband had a very interesting spin on the whole story with Rabbi Akiva and his students. So what was the message? So she said, he used to say, Josh Alav Hashalom used to say that what did Rabbi Akiva's students, how did such a tragedy occur? So we know that Rabbi Akiva left his wife. His wife sent him away to study for 12 years, and then he came back. And then he overheard her saying, I'd be happy if he would go away another 12 years. I'm so happy that he's doing this. So what Rabbi Akiva's students missed out on is that they never got to see Rabbi Akiva with his wife and to learn what it meant to treat another person with respect, a couple, because they call them 12,000 couples. They were 12,000 zugot, 24,000 students, but the Gemara always refers to it as the 12,000 pairs. So Josh said, you know what? Josh was a psychologist, on top of being a rabbi as well. And he said, you know what they missed out on is that they never got to see Rabbi Akiva together with his wife to see the practical, you know, experience of life of seeing their teacher with his wife and what it means to treat another person with respect. And that was what they missed. They never got to see. And it actually fits in very well with what they teach us in many places. It says, Gadol Shimush HaMimiludim. It's like it's greater. The most important thing for us to learn is to be able to see people practically living their lives, to learn from our teachers and how they live their lives. It's not enough to hear a class, nice, but how does that person translate all these teachings, like we just said, into the practical, into everyday life? Like, you know, and so it's something that, you know, that's the greatest teaching moment, when you get to see not just this incredible, you know, mind, but to see how they incorporate and they integrate these things into their lives. That's what Rabbi Akiva's students missed out on when they didn't get to see him with Rabbi Akiva with his wife. And that unfortunately led to their demise. That was his read, which I thought was very novel, but it also, I thought, very, very powerful.
It's right on. I actually, there's a story, it reminds me of a story that, I don't know who said it, it's probably a famous story, but there were these very amazing students who were learning, and they were older, and it was getting close to a holiday, a chag, and everyone left except for this group of students that they're still learning Torah, and they're learning. And the teacher comes to them and says, "Listen, I have some people who are in need of some help, some mitzvah. If you're ready," and he tells them, "You know, there are these families that need help with their children or whatever," and the students are so excited to hear, and obviously always looking for an opportunity. And he looks at them and says, "It's your families, your wife, your children, they're waiting for you to." Home is great, but you have to go. They need help preparing.
Like, right. Wow, anyway, that's harsh. But yeah, that's yeah. That's a story. So Lag BaOmer coming up Monday night. Tuesday is a very special day. It's a day of integration. It's glory upon glory, hod shebahod. But it's you know, it's the idea of integration, that we're able to integrate, you know, take all these positive things and then bring it into our lives. And then the takeaway also is, like you said, like Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, 12 years in intense, and he needed more. We always need more to study more, incorporate more, and always realize that we're always on a path of growth. We're never at the finish line. We're seeking. We're supposed to be seekers, and if we do that, then we stay young and vibrant and new, like the idea of the Omer offering and everything else that's incorporated here. And that we should be blessed, that we should see the end of this craziness, and that we should also be fortunate to take away all the positives that have come out of it. A lot of good things have happened, you know. Like, if you know, a lot of good things can be learned in terms of the special times, or maybe it's difficulties. We get pushed into things that are not so easy, but from that we gain a tremendous amount as well.
Yeah.
So we should be able to be blessed to take away the good things.
That's right.